Okay, on the presence. We talked about some of the practical stuff 2 weeks ago about what it means for God to really kind of be there. We did this in reverse order, so we were going to talk a little bit more of the philosophy here. Again, a little bit of a shameless plug. This is helping me out for in advance of November. But William Lane Craig, who I think a lot of people in this class listen to or from whom a lot of the ideas that have been articulated in this class have come, at least through him, has said that the place in theology today, that there has been virtually no writing. And when I think he's talking mostly in the scholarly articles, what people are doing dissertations on, what people are doing or writing journal articles about and stuff like that, is omnipresence. There's basically nothing out there on omnipresence. Basically nothing out there.
That's an irony.
Yeah, isn't it? There, you cannot find anywhere omnipresence in the writing, in the scholarly writing. So what he has said is basically, this is a very open field for research. Now, why is that important to us? For two reasons, I think. One, when people don't write on a certain topic, sometimes it's indicative of the fact that you look at the topic and you just kind of scratch your head and say, can't even think of a way that this makes sense. So I'm just going to kind of skip over that part and go to the stuff that I'm comfortable with or that I know or that I feel like I can think about. The other advantage here is, if there are major parts of a theory, and let's talk, theories, what we're talking about are like theories of who God is, what he's like, and specifically the important stuff for Christians is how do you put all these scriptures about God together into a cohesive picture that makes sense. It may be the case that this is the key to unlocking that, right? If the amount of writing that's been done on, the amount of thinking that's been done on over 2,000 years and more, is relatively small, is it possible that we're missing something relatively big there? And I don't know the answer to that question, but let's say the answer is maybe, in which case it's worth at least a look. So we're going to take at least a look today, and I'll give you a couple of ideas that I think where the key may be missing. I'd be interested to hear your thoughts and feedback on that. I've written up here, this list is only out of my head based on a little bit of research that I've done into this topic in either the literature or descriptions of the literature, probably more accurate. How it is that we have anciently and modernly thought of omnipresence. And I'll tell you why it's become more important today. In our society today, we are starting to buy into, we are automatically educating our children, educating ourselves, and taking as assumptions things that are coming out of 20th century physics. So relativity theory, and especially the way relativity theory treats space and time, is starting to pervade the way that we think. I'll give you some examples of that. People will say things like, there's no absolutes. Now that's a philosophical statement that is often ported into a moral statement, but that some of that comes through the lens of physics that we've had today, because what they'll say is, not even time is absolute. There is no way to determine a correct time or that there is a time. And the implication there is, if that's the case, and God's supposed to know what time it is, or he's supposed to have a unity of his own consciousness that fills the whole universe. Well, that can't be the case because there is no one time for the whole universe. And that's the view of many physicists today. Unbelievably, I kid you not. Has anybody heard of the books, either Cryptonomicon or Anathem? For math geeks, these are the Chronicles of Narnia for math geeks. It's a guy that writes, he's a mathematician, and he writes about how he wishes the world was. Needless to say, religious people are way down here as kind of the ignorant laity who never got it right, and the people who believe in pure mathematics are the real elite, that both intellectual and ultimately powerful. They become powerful at the end. So it follows the same kind of course you'd expect it to when written by somebody of that mindset. He is a no-kidding Platonist. Like the old dude Plato, there exist out there triangles that are real. They're just a whole world of triangles and squares and circles and numbers and all that stuff. That's the real reality. And what you see here is the shadow world. And it's really a variation in, he goes into mathematical constructs, that this is a variation in and he calls it him space, but basically like a Hilbert space or a possibility space, that there are millions and millions and millions of worlds constantly fragmenting all the different ways that it could go. It's multiverse plus. It's stuff that you thought like thousands of years ago we got rid of that, or 1,000 years ago we stopped thinking that type of stuff. No, in fact, it's back, and it's back with vengeance. And there are some studies out there that indicate that the if not majority, the largest of the minorities view of mathematicians philosophically is Platonism. Now that's important to the Christian. And it's important to us because a lot of what you believe has been unwittingly influenced by this as well. Do you think that the soul is immortal? Do you know that the idea that the soul is immortal is not principally found in ancient Hebrew theology? The idea that the soul is immortal is a Greek idea that was, and some people would accuse Christians of adopting. But the reality is, whether it was a progressive revelation or whatever, you go ask the ancient Jew who is in the time of Genesis, Exodus, Deuteronomy, all that kind of stuff, does the soul live forever? The answer is no. You are from dust you are, to dust you shall return. And when the hope was the resurrection, that you will be built again, like Adam was built or something similar, to then live forever with access to the tree of life and all that kind of thing. So the idea of this immortal soul that floats off somewhere that comes back in was considered by some to be a Greek invention that was adopted by Christians.
Liar's paradise.
And so you've got to wonder sometimes whether, remembering that theology itself is a human discipline. It's a discipline of thought. We take scripture, and let's for the sake of argument, just say that, pretend that every theologian agrees that scripture is correct, complete, inerrant in its original form, all the things that maybe the most conservative side would say about the Bible. So you can go to the Bible, but theology is the interpretation of the Bible, and it's the building of a system. Because there's no book in there that says the essence and properties of God. That does not lie between 1st and 2nd Chronicles. That is a construct that we put together as theologians, as people, as laity, saying this is how we think about God. So don't ever get too bent out of shape about people attacking theology. If you want to get bent out of shape about people attacking God himself or about scripture, get bent out of shape about that. But you can't get too bent out of shape about people attacking theology because we humans do build that. So if we're going to build that, we just need to first understand what it is that we're already kind of led to think that we may not have meant to accept ahead of time. Such things are some of these Greek ideas that continue in there. And the reason I've also said before, quoted the guy before, I forget who said it, but you have heard it said, all Western philosophy is basically footnotes to Plato. There is some truth in that. It's a little bit of an overreach, but there's some truth to that. The philosophical fights that are going on right now in the Evangelical Philosophical Society and the Evangelical Theological Society are the same fights that were happening in ancient Greek philosophy and early Christianity. Your best example is there's a guy named Peter Van Inwagen, who's a philosopher, a relatively famous philosopher in Christian circles. He's a Platonist, literally believes in Platonic objects. I don't have a really clear understanding of how he thinks God interacts with them, but I think that he thinks that they exist necessarily and God exists necessarily. Whether he's responsible for them or not, that's something I don't really understand about his view. But at the end of the day, bottom line, there's a no-joke Platonist who's considered a very mainstream Christian philosopher. He will tell you that his ideas are different than the majority of philosophy, but philosophy writ large is, Christian philosophy is very much listening to him and interacting with him. To such a point that the journal of the Evangelical Philosophical Society is currently hosting a written debate back and forth between William Lane Craig, another guy that you probably haven't heard, and Peter Van Inwagen, talking about which of these is true. This is stuff happening today. Your theology, and when I say your theology, I mean Mike Minner's theology, I mean the elders' theology, that is influenced by where? Where do you think they got their theology? You think they read the Bible and just made it up?
Bible college.
Yeah, the bottom line is it came from academia. a lot of their understanding comes from academia. When you choose to go to Dallas Theological Seminary, you are saying, generally I agree with these guys, but once you go in there, you're, and I don't mean wrongly, but you are indoctrinated in inserted doctrine, teaching. Teaching is put inside you. Yes, some people will disagree with what they say, but a lot of it is you're trained in that doctrine and theology. If you choose to go to Harvard Divinity School, you're going to get a very different theology than you do at DTS, but the bottom line is your selection of where to go has maybe the most influence on what your theology is. And what you can't forget is that the ladies and gentlemen, in this case gentlemen, who are responsible for teaching us our doctrine in this church, have come to it through academia. So I make that point solely to point out, if people in Solid Ground are serious about what I think that you're serious about, which is we really do want to think about these things for ourselves, we unfortunately are stuck doing something that we don't really want to do. We're stuck having to think and interact, if you want to do it meaningfully, at the same level that these scholars are, that are writing the papers, that then eventually become the ideas that get written in the textbooks that are then used in these schools. So as an example, the Blackwell Companion to Natural Theology is a textbook at Biola University that has significant contributions from two guys, J.P. Moreland and Wade Wayne Gray. So these guys are their own academic papers are what's influencing the textbook that's training the next group of people who are then leading your churches. So, lest you think that this stuff is abstract, this is airy-fairy stuff, it doesn't have any impact, what is absent today will be absent in 100 years in Christianity. So if you want to have an impact in Christianity, what if your class, this class, writes some of the papers? And I'm not saying you all have to actually do it, but I want you to know that when I interact with you and you talk back to me, ideas that have been raised by people in this class have absolutely made it in the papers now that are getting presented at theological and philosophical societies. So you can potentially have an impact, especially if they end up with some sort of promulgation now through the literature. You could be helping inform the theology of the next 100 years or more. Steve?
I was just thinking, I guess here's the point though, I haven't gone to seminary, but just going through secular humanities and going through it with the mindset of, I believe the Bible, let's go take this to town, and writing my own theodicies when we go through philosophy, that there's a point, there's some value to having different perspectives, but I guess it depends on the person. I mean, if you will adopt certain views, but if you're stubborn,
right.
It could be good. So I don't know.
And there's something to that, and obviously I come very much sympathetic to that view. But at some point, you do have to say, some of this orthodoxy is orthodox for a good reason, which is a lot of smart guys and gals thought about it, and they were like, yeah, no, I thought about all the stuff you're thinking about. So a lot of times, I get all ramped up about something like, this can't possibly be right, and I run into the five different good arguments that lay out. I'm like, oh, okay. But yeah, I think the same way you do. All right, so that was a lot of attempt on my part to get you bought into the project of at least thinking about the stuff that can be otherwise relatively dry. But I want you to know how important it is that you interject, raise your hand, give feedback, disagree, talk about it, because this is very important to me and maybe to us and to the Christendom as a whole, God willing. I put these five things up here because these are my understanding of what is called the classical view of omnipresence. Again, which is not terribly well fleshed out from the attestations that I can hear, but I'm interested in your thoughts on it because these five things, when taken in conjunction, suggest a few things to me. I'm interested in what they suggest to you. So I'll just very quickly run by them. Most of them seem self-explanatory. Some people say, these are the theological greats, Aquinas and others, guys up in his ilk. God is present by his knowledge. But we talked about that 2 or 3 weeks ago. God's present by his knowledge in that because he knows what's going on, that's what comprises his omnipresence, or that's part of what comprises his omnipresence. And we said at the time, if you're monitoring something on a video screen somewhere else, does that, you're present by your knowledge of it, but does that mean that you're present? And now we're talking about what the term present means, etc. So just that's one thing. Present by his power is another way people say things. So present by his power is he has the ability to affect whatever he wills in any place in which he is omnipresent, which would be everywhere. So that would be, he can make stuff happen on Pluto, he can make stuff happen in this room, and he can make stuff happen somewhere else. However, what I didn't write in here is present by his power whilst not being physically present. And when you ask, well, how is that done? You get a little bit of this in the theology. Well, we don't know, but we know that he can affect things with his power everywhere else, or everywhere. 3 and 4, that he's a creator of all. Now, this to me is not terribly important from an omnipresence perspective, because if he started it out at like a singularity and sent it forward, all he had to do is be present there for a second or a millisecond or whatever and launch it, and it could be on its own after that. But he sustains all. So God is said to be causally active at all points, all the time. Causally active at all points. And what we mean is, you'll hear it said sometimes, like, if God stopped thinking about the world, it would disappear out of existence. It would go lapse into non-being. So that somehow these two combined are really, maybe 1 and 2, cause this to happen. He's present by his knowledge, he's present by his power, and as the creator of it and sustainer of it, if he were to stop being present by his knowledge and power, so too would that reality stop. It would cease to exist. Now, there's a whole bunch of views on how that is, how that happens, but that's just something that seems to me to be part of the classical view. Yes, sir?
I think you answered my question, but I was just going to say 4 basically includes 1 and 2.
That's right. That's
and
right.
By your definition, 3 as well.
Yeah, 3 is not as important as 1, 2, and 4 in this. I put 3 in there only to say, you could probably erase 3 in from this list and still be
able to. I mean, frankly, it looks to me like you could erase all but 4.
Well, except that I want to call out that we are not saying that God, there are a few things that are implied by all of this, and maybe this is a good point to mention it before we get to 5, but the classical view isn't that God has a body, or that the universe is God's body, or as Isaac Newton wanted to argue, but this is not Isaac Newton argued something that was opposite or different than classical theism. Newton, does anybody know what Newton's term was for kind of the world, what he considered space-time in the world? God's sensorium. So it was kind of the way that God sensed everything that was out there and that he interacted with it. That's not the classical view. The classical view is that it's not a body, is not connected to him in any real way, kind of like a physical thing, but that he's somehow another way there. And then that's why I get to this one right here, because like we talked about a little bit last time, it's the question of, you know, let's say now, forgetting the old Jewish view and going to the more Greek view, your soul or your mind, is it present here in your hand? Is it present in your brain? Is it only in your forebrain? Is it in your hypothalamus? Is it in your corpus callosum? You know, looking at, if you've ever seen the Descartes drawings on this one, they're entertaining by today's standards. Wholly present at every point, we'd say this. Yours is the idea that Al's soul is wholly present throughout his body, but it is not at any point solely present. So if I cut off Al's arm, he doesn't lose part of his soul. Now his soul is wholly present in that which remains of him. Like maybe contiguous, I don't know. How long? Tis but a flesh wound. You know, if you reattach it, which seems to happen with some amazing skill nowadays, does the soul refill back in the arm, or was it gone in the first place? I don't know. So wholly present at every point means that God is wholly present at this point, but he's not limited to being present at this point. Yes, ma'am.
It may be not related, but the characteristics of this omnipresence, is that why you support total annihilation instead of eternal torment that you mentioned a couple weeks ago?
Yes. So some of the classical view is that God is present in hell in this way. Is that it's the relational presence of God that's gone for the people who would be in hell, where the idea is eternal conscious torment. That God is still there sustaining hell's existence, because if he wasn't, it would cease to exist. It's part of reality from which God is relationally absent, but he's causally active there by sustaining it in existence and by sustaining those people in existence. So that's I'm all for the skeptical view you're laying out, because that's not a view that I hold. I think that is a weakness in the classical view that is non-intuitive to me and against which I would at least like to try to argue. Not to argue, not because I want to argue against Scripture. I don't want to argue arguing Scripture. I want to argue in accordance with Scripture, but I'll argue that that view, that theology, is not exactly right, that something is missing or slightly off with it. So that's one thing I think that you brought up at one point. What are other things that you can think of that make these things either not fit well together or are somehow very not prima facie,
so
not
this,
well evidence?
Like, everything that you've laid out here is within kind of the rational space and time, physical space and time. But God's omnipresence is actually broader than that. We say that God is omnipresent outside of space and time. So you almost have, there's almost a separate set of omnipresence, especially when you start talking about the beginning of the universe.
Yes. I'm drawing up here to help illustrate your point so you can tell us how you like this diagram done. This is the classical non-Hartle Hawking, Big Bang model. Or if you're not a Big Bang fan, this is God speaking the world in existence and rolling out the heavens like a scroll. This is the bottom line, this is the point of creation where there wasn't anything at this point, or that's the first time there was anything. That this line represents time, and space is basically on this axis right here. You reduce three dimensions to two dimensions, but this is time, and this is space. And this is quote unquote before creation over here on this side, but that this cone represents all of physical reality. And if I understand what Scott was saying is, God is not confined to this physical reality, which is also the classical view. That's the reason, that's one of the reasons why this is said right here, that the universe cannot be said to contain God,
right,
in any room.
Yeah.
Right. So how would you want to add anything to this that helps underscore your point?
I mean, it's almost as if that cone exists in infinite space, and God, all of that discussion is about within the cone, and God actually exists outside in all the infinite space that surrounds it.
Okay, so I'll put a sixth point up here, which is God is transcendent. I don't remember how to spell it. Somebody correct me. God is transcendent. Is that right? Is that correct? Okay. God is transcendent. So, in this diagram, what it means is this. He's not just here. That God's existence transfers either way. So God is here, and God is here. And that even though this border represents something very significant for us,
it's
God gets to be on both sides of the borders.
Does omnipresence have any, and I guess my question is twofold. Does it have any significance or meaning when talking about something that's not spatial, like outside of the physical universe? And then two, is that backed up by Scripture?
Well, that's
my assertion, is that it is.
Okay.
It does apply to outside of the physical space.
But how can you talk about presence in a non-physical space?
Right.
That makes my mind hurt. So,
yes.
Uh-huh.
Absolutely.
So what are the ways that it could be? We could talk about presence in non-physical space. Is non-physical space a logical self-contradiction?
I don't know.
No.
I've tried to think about the opposite.
Okay.
Nothing. Try to think about nothing.
Okay. I'm pretty good at that, depending on the time of day.
But then, by the fact of thinking of it, you're thinking about nothing. So is that nothing? It just blows my mind every time I try to do it.
That's definition of nothing. Anybody know what it is? Aristotle's definition. That about which rocks dream.
Yeah.
Let's we've already drawn this in a way that's problematic to answering your question. Not even problematic, it's completely unhelpful. It's the opposite of helpful than answering the question, which is we say, well, here's this space here that's physical space, and we want to think about this space out here, which is non-physical space. And you're like, well, but you drew it as on a physical board. Yes, that's a problem. So we can at least do one step when it comes to presence in non-physical space that's binary. What's the binary? I think Steve has given us a hint towards it. But if you want to know whether Al's mind is present in non-physical space, what can we say about Al's mind that can indicate It's the most basic indication of whether it, quote unquote, is or is not in that physical space. It's the most basic.
How about a thought?
Okay, yeah, or what do you need to even have a thought? What do you need to have a mind at all? What does the mind have to have? It's not a property necessarily, but it has to. This is an awkward way to ask a question.
Right, well, yeah,
existence is a question, right? So you can say, you know, your mind either exists or it does not exist. If your mind exists, and if your mind is not present, is solely present in physical space, then it has to be present in some way in non-physical space. So existence is the first level. It's a zero or one of I exist or I don't exist in non-physical space. Now, can you say anything else about existing in the immaterial? Let's not restrict ourselves to the term non-physical. Let's say immaterial, which is just a fancy way of saying non-physical, but it is very specific. It says not matter, immaterial, not matter. So what if you think about it in that way? What if you think about it and say, well, it doesn't have to be materially present. What does that give you? What might that give you that you didn't have before? Maybe even on this diagram. Where does that let you start drawing immaterial things on this diagram of Skyler's?
I'm just thinking of a light going through it.
Yeah, right.
But that's Plato's cave, but you know.
So let me redraw this one as here's a rubber sheet that represents reality now. We turn it from a cone into a sheet. Now it's a two-dimensional universe. Can you, you said, okay, here's material stuff. And by that, I mean matter and energy. This is atoms, or this is dark energy or dark matter, if such a thing exists, that kind of stuff. So if you're going to exist on this sheet, you got to have matter going on too. And that's like our bodies. We know our bodies, we seem to think that our bodies are like that. This is the best explanation to my knowledge of our bodies. These are material things that exist on this material sheet. Well, what if there's an overlay sheet or underlay, depending on how you want to put it, in the ancient Greek substantia or Latin substantia, that is immaterial? And what if it correlates one for one with material reality? Now what you've got is, you've got space that is not, let's say this is space like this is space. This is space like this is space. But this space has nothing physical in it. But this space, I'll just put it out. So we're leaving time out here. There is Al's body. And if you map this thing to where it's laid over, on the exact same spot is where Al's mind is. Now you say, well, is that mind extended in this space, or is it simply a point in this space? Now we're into a discussion of whether an immaterial thing can be extended in space or not extended in space. So that's one way to think of it. Does that one have any problems? Is this overlay idea problematic, or does it answer the question?
Well, you did say it's one-to-one, so put a rock in there. Is there a sulfur rock or a mic rock?
Yeah, I'm going to say that would be an analog of empty space in the immaterial world. So where there is a rock, there is nothing present in that immaterial world there.
What happens when Al dies?
What does happen when Al dies? Does that mean this happens? Al's mind is still there, right, in this immaterial space. What popular stories look like this?
This is ghosts.
This is ghosts. This house was where somebody was murdered, and their soul, you know, their spirit is still there. So that idea almost assumes this thing right here.
Al, sorry, but he might have died.
Hang on.
He might have died, but his dot doesn't disappear. Doesn't his matter just change?
So now Al's been
atomized
a little bit. He's starting to spread out a little bit, right? So Al's a little more diffused in this world, and he's a little more localized in this one.
What happens if we clone Al?
Well, let's say that we'll pretend, for the sake of brevity of the argument, that cloning doesn't clone the spirit. The clone that wherever the spirit or mind comes from, let's say, for the sake of ease, that God sticks it in there when he creates it. That the creation of a that when two people have, you know, make a baby, that God is creating a soul to put in there. Let's say that that's a way. Another way is maybe he made a well of souls, and he pulls out 173A and sticks that one in. And that
you can look at
the body. How it happens, but let's say that that's
it. You can look at the first body as an anchor point for that soul. So if you were to clone them, the soul would still be in that first anchor point.
But everybody agrees that the cloned person is not, the mind isn't cloned in that person. So if you clone somebody, so what's a natural clone? A natural clone is a twin. So a twin, twin A and twin B, or Tom and Jim, they don't have the same mind. Everybody knows that. So if they don't have the same mind, you assume they also don't have the same soul. Mind and soul are correlated. So the reality is, God, when the zygote splits, God just sticks another one in mouth.
I guess I was thinking more.
Or maybe God doesn't stick the soul in until some point later. Who knows?
I guess
or
I was thinking more
along the lines
of like sci-fi clones or something like that. In terms of like, we make a duplicate of the body. Is that like now a soulless creature wandering around? And it's like on the material, but it doesn't have like a corollary in the immaterial.
Yeah, Dr. Frankenstein built his monster. Is the fact that he tied together five different bodies or whatever else. And whose soul was in that body?
See, they share.
And I think at the end of the day, maybe, if God does create the souls and put them in there, and he wants to use human reproduction in order to do so, then you would assume that he wouldn't allow Frankenstein's monster to ever live. So the it's alive moment won't actually happen in the real world. It remains to be seen whether that happens. If you can do that, if you can make a person from completely not coming from us, you know, even when we do IVF and all those kinds of things, it's just a fancy way of doing the same thing that happens naturally outside the human being's body. But to truly build a human being and have them endowed with a soul, if that were to happen, would probably be strong evidence for what? Say the person's walking around, all intents and purposes, seems like every other person in this room. What hypothesis would that support of the things that we talked about? And to me, it's an ancient Jewish idea of, that there isn't actually an immaterial soul or spirit kind of thing, or maybe even mind, that it really is. We are really physical beings, and that at the resurrection, we will be undiffused, or new parts will be put together to make us into the soul that God breathes into us. So but that remains to be seen. Nobody's built Frankenstein's monster.
Well, it's just curious. So various, I think Ephesians is one where it talks about items in the heavenly realms, and just that just kind of. I've always just tried to understand that, and one of the ways that I've thought about it is not necessarily non-material, but just a different thing that I can perceive, or different other things that may be material if I had extra senses.
Yeah, so that's an interesting way. Now, if that's the case, if there are things that are, so we know there are things that are extrasensory to us, and I don't mean weird ESP stuff, but I mean, you know, muons that are streaming through this room super fast right now, cascading, and they're very high energy particles. They're relatively high energy particles. And here they are zipping through our room all the time, but we don't see them, these cosmic rays kind of thing. So we don't perceive them, doesn't mean that they're not there. So it could be in the same way the mantis shrimp. I saw the most dumb YouTube videos about true facts about the mantis shrimp. Apparently, they're able to see three or four more colors than we can. That's kind of an interesting idea that there are more colors than we can see, but apparently, you know, than the human eye can see. But that is true. So, are there things in the colors that we can't see? Now, they still should be detectable if the four fundamental forces are, or three are, you know, gravity, strong, electro weak, that kind of stuff. If those forces are there, they're still there. They're still detectable. They just may not be visible to human beings, or we, with our normal unaided senses, can't find them. So we got to build scientific equipment or other kind of equipment to find these things. So that's a possibility, but I've never heard anybody say the soul is that. And if that's, you know, it's a possibility, but that would be a novelty. Anything else with this, any other problems with this overlay? Is that a good, easy solution to the problem of, well, how do I conceive of where the soul is in a world if the soul is not material? Well, can you just overlay a spiritual world and a material world one for one onto the physical world? Maybe, but what else? What are other problems with that? You can think of
time.
Okay. In what way?
I don't know. I just the it seems very static, at least in your God.
Well, it's the physical characteristic of the drawing right now. I think Steve's.
All right, so we'll shortcut that one and say, I drew the sheet flat, but if you want to warp the sheet, I didn't draw the grid on it, but if you want to warp the sheet to be in compliance with general relativity, then you would identically warp the immaterial world as well by saying this.
Well,
the mapping happens where the logically prior thing that happens is the physical world shape, and that the immaterial world is laid onto the physical world and not the other way around. So if you do that, then there is no feature of the material world that lacks a feature, that lacks attachment, so to speak, by the immaterial world, because you let the physical world drive where the immaterial world is laid on, for those that are worried about the relative.
But if you start warping these things together and moving around, you know, is it just our confirmation bias that says that the material world dictates what's going on in the immaterial one? Why can't it be the other way? I mean, you start shifting this stuff around, and all of a sudden, these alternative realities start.
So that's a very important question. Why can't it be the other way? Now, it has to be able to be the case that the immaterial world affects the material world in some way. And what way is that at a minimum? If we're going to posit immaterial minds, what's the minimum way that that has to happen, that the immaterial world affects the material world?
All right, I've got a question, then I have a thought. The question is, in this scenario, does the mind always exist as the soul? So,
right. I think. Well, does it always exist? I think you could do either one. So maybe say either one's fine.
Okay. So take away that second layer, and just imagine that cone that you have up there, but invert it 90 degrees.
Yeah.
To the counterclockwise.
Yeah.
And now draw in the grid.
Yeah.
So that you have this warped grid, not warped as in decadent, but
right.
You have. Although it would indicate warp. But you would have that warp going down essentially to a point. And then it's beyond that point that all of these things exist.
But if you're going to do that because the time arrow is now, you know, moving in reverse from top to bottom, if you're going to do that, you end up talking about existence before it exists, which I don't
know. No, it correlates back directly to the point of creation.
Yeah, but I think that's what, yes. But I think you can get the same result by mapping the immaterial world on the material world. It just means that the immaterial world would also be a singularity if that's the way that it started out initially. But that's an interesting way of looking at it. My original question, though, is it possible, what are the ways that the immaterial world does affect the material world? So we're talking about mapping. I was only saying that the immaterial world is mapped onto the material world in that order, but how do we know the immaterial world must affect the material world if this model is right?
So is this finite
or
infinite?
Well, it could be either, but let's say that it's finite for ease of argumentation.
Do you have an example?
I'm
struggling.
Here's one right here.
Okay.
Okay, so my immaterial mind, if that's the way that it says to my brain, command my left hand to release the pen. So here the immaterial world has reached into the material world, so to speak, and said, cause these neurons to fire, that then cause these neurons to fire, that then send a signal to these muscles and they let go. So the mind does affect, in this model, would affect the material world. And if it works in that direction, what else works in that direction? And that wasn't and you have to answer the question, just merely to say, are there other categories of yes.
I think this is really hard to get through because I keep going back to the C.S. Lewis quote of you are a soul, you have a body.
Yes.
Like the implication being that we almost exist in the immaterial world and act, interact in the material world.
Right.
And I think that's a hard when you talk about which way does the mapping go.
Yes.
It's hard because so much of our, obviously all our senses and all our interactions are in this material world. But if you want to hold tight to what is doctrinally and spiritually important, you want to look at the immaterial world and focus on the immaterial world, which is obviously much harder and less intuitive.
Yes. I think, let's say that you want to do it that way. If you're going to say what Lewis says, then I think what you end up with is saying that the quote-unquote real world, or the most important world, or the the one that matters most, is this one. And that as I've drawn it here, this is the foundational world. And that this one right here exists to, in some way, illustrate what this is. So, but that...
You're really getting into Indian philosophy on this now.
Well, by his argument, that's not Indian philosophy. That can be Christian philosophy. That's the idea that the immaterial... And then maybe this is Platon. Another way of looking at this is Platon. So Platonism says, here's the world of the abstract objects or whatever. Although Platonism might make 3 or 4 or 5 or a million of these kind of things, and they just go on down. But ultimately, this idea can be in some ways Platonic to some, and Hindu thought, as much as it maps onto Platonism or onto this, yes, there will be some commonalities there. If people are wondering, they're like, well, you know what? I don't like the idea of this having to map one for one. And instead, what you want to do is say that I think I'll certainly not draw this correctly, but this is meant to represent, you know, kind of a globe. And this globe now is not the world, this globe is the universe. So this now represents a spherical universe and the surface of it, so this is the stuff you commonly see in the textbooks, the surface of it is the world that we see here. Well, what if in the center of this globe, that's the immaterial world, and that for anything that's in here, it plugs back to here, anything that's in this grid, it plugs back to here. And so what you basically get is you get the center, so to speak, of the universe is...
So those extraneous dots are lying on the surface.
Yeah, and that they are connected in some way. These are lying on the surface of that globe, and they're connected back to this center point, which may be a mathematical singularity, is not extended in space anyway. But that all the souls and minds and God himself and all that kind of stuff are there. And that the world in some projection, not a projection of what's here, but that it's connected causally via whatever this means is. This is now the mysterious thing. Whatever this means is that connection right there is the transcendent connection that connects the physical world with a now non-spatial immaterial world. Okay, so this is a spatial version of the immaterial world. This is a non-spatial version of the immaterial world.
Well, that's what my inverted cone did.
Yeah, right. Oh, so you didn't want T to be a time arrow.
No.
Okay.
It doesn't have to be time.
So if you take the time factor out of this, expanding, this thing's getting bigger and bigger and bigger, so this causal connection would be stretching out, but it's not meant to have any meaning as to its length.
Right.
Okay, so those are maybe a couple ways that you can turn around and say, these are how the material and immaterial worlds are tied together. But the reason I bring this up is, just to say something that we all maybe intuitively know, which is it's really hard to explain how the immaterial and the material interact. Theology tends to do it this way. It tends to say this transcendent word is the, you guys have seen the comic strip, illustration of the two scientific guys, and he's got all this, these mathematics on the board, and he goes, you know, this, and then a miracle happens, and then whatever, he's got this black box there. But the black box is transcendence, that whatever transcendence that we know, that we want to say it this way, we know that there's an immaterial reality, we know there's a material reality, they have to communicate in some way because we see people dropping pens and God existing. So transcendence does happen, transcendence is mysterious. What we're trying to do here, though, is enlighten transcendence a little bit. What is transcendence the right concept, and if so, how does it work?
What's the main difference between 5 and 6?
That you could argue from maybe a panentheistic perspective that God and the universe are the same. They're contained in the same space. This right here says that God exists outside, quote unquote, of the universe. The universe that cannot be said to contain. So this is that's the only thing. They're the same thing except for calling God out. Somebody else have a comment?
Yes, I was just going to say, the biggest thing is trying to decouple time and space. And I think space is the big question mark. I think time is the big question mark. But
space you present that to that view.
This is a bigger question mark because, that could potentially answer if we had a better definition of space.
But even if you decouple time and space, all that does is take one dimension out of the problem that you're supposed to be working. And I've already cheated and taken at least 2 dimensions out of the problems that we're working here. So... We still end up with a space problem. It's really on omnipresence. The space problem is a big problem.
Okay, so I've got two thoughts on this. One I want to dismiss because I can't explain it. The other I want to dismiss because it's too easy.
Okay.
So if we're trying to figure out transcendence, that's all about how whatever that God message is gets to whatever material and immaterial world you want over here.
Yes.
So it's a transportation issue.
Okay.
So either at the beginning, the messages were like implanted in us, and we're just following directions.
Okay.
We just can't see ahead of them.
Okay.
That's the cheat.
Yeah.
Right? There is no transcendence. It happened at the beginning.
Okay.
The other one is, well, how is it continuing to happen? So that would be before. How is it sustaining?
So before you go further, is your first point determinism?
If you say so.
Okay.
That's a big word with lots of vowels.
Determinism meaning it's all set from the beginning and there's no free will. It's all...
No.
Okay.
It's all set in the beginning. There is free will. Just because the messages are there, it doesn't mean we're reading ahead.
So in this question you're asking, on the cheat, where does the free will interact? Where is it? So maybe another way to put it in your terms are, forget the term soul, forget the term spirit, forget the term mind. Let's say that those are annoying to you. You at least know you've got a will, because you're like, I will go to this class, or I am now tired of talking about this, or whatever it is. You feel, you say, I will choose to do this or that. Where does that reside, that will? I'm a fan, by the way, of talking of the soul, spirit, and mind. I'm erasing those terms because they're so loaded with meaning and definition and debate, and saying will. So I'm a human body with an immaterial will. And then now people have to come up with new definitions of will. But let's say that I'm asking the will question.
I don't know, man. You're baiting my will a little bit.
Then try question two. What's the one that's too easy?
What's the one? Oh, the one that's, well, that was the one that was too easy.
I'll
just throw that out immediately. Yeah, so it was really, you know, I guess determinism, you know, it's encoded in the beginning.
Yeah.
And the will occurs when, I don't know, the message is released or you finally read it or whatever, whether or not you choose to follow it or what have you.
So that is
a good question. Where is the will?
Where is the you that's choosing to follow? All right, good way of illustrating it, but it certainly calls into sharp relief what it is that we're really asking about, which again, to me, can the minimum version can always be this, where's my will? That's what we want to ask. Is my will in my brain? Is it sitting there in my frontal lobe? Is my will somewhere else in the brain, or is it immaterial? Yes, sir.
I mean, you can cogently argue that there is no free will. I know it's a little counterintuitive, but it's possible it's just some sort of illusion.
Yep.
So I don't think that alone should be a reason for any sort of deterministic argument.
At a minimum, it's arguing in a circle or assuming that what you have to prove and say, well, free will exists, and that's how we know determinism doesn't. Yeah. So I agree with you. If you're going to establish the existence of free will, I will cheat on it and put the burden on the person who can test free will and say this. Does anybody disagree that we at least intuitively believe that we have free will? And most people, I think everybody says yes. I.e. that you have to learn something else about the world to be like, well, it looks like it, but it's an illusion. Okay, well then I'm going to grab Plantinga's view and say, then believing in free will is a properly basic belief, and I'm rational to believe in free will up until the point that I encounter a defeater for that viewpoint that means that I can't both be rational and still hold the viewpoint. And right now, I don't know of any defeater for the existence of free will, unless you go put Frankenstein's monster together and... He acts like a human being. This is in philosophy, this is the problem is called zombies. They talk about zombies, where zombies appear to all intents and purposes to be people, but the reality is they don't have minds like you do. They're zombies. They're acting on some deterministic process. So you're right. It's not a counter to determinism, but I think it's intuitive enough that I want to at least start from that as, if not axiomatic, at least the most reasonable position from which to go. But how do you think that the existence of free will affects this problem, unless you're going to say, you don't have to worry about this one because the idea of will may not even be, it may be an illusion. That the reality is it's just a material world.
Well, we spent a lot of time talking about how could the immaterial influence the material, how could there be that causal link, but maybe there is no causal link, and if there isn't, maybe we don't need this mapping mechanism.
Is it the case that, okay, true, now how do you account for God? How do you account for God?
I mean, he could have just set everything up correctly from the start, just let it run out.
But I mean, God has...
Or he can be intervening, but he has some separate mechanism, which isn't like a one-to-one mapping, but it's just something unique to him that we don't really do.
Okay, that's plausible. What would be, any ideas about what that might be?
I think a slightly different model would be that our world is sort of exists in some other physical world,
okay.
But it's sort of a tiny model within that world, maybe like a simulation or, you know, a miniature version.
Okay.
And God created that model. He can mess with it. He can interact with it if he wants, or he can let it just sort of play out. And we're entirely within that model. We can never step out of it. Nothing about us is outside of it. But he exists outside of it. In some other world, maybe it's physical, maybe it's of some other nature. I think that's...
Yeah, that was going to be my other question. Do you think that world has to be physical, or do you think it cannot be physical, or do you not have any...
Either way, I don't see why we should be boxed in at this point.
If it is, let's pretend that it is physical, that other world is physical, is it also material?
Could be, or it could be immaterial.
So if it's both physical and material, then maybe you could say... Well, we've talked about a region of it as being separate and being our universe, but in reality, it's just now observable universe, and the rest of that is universe because it's material. And so we want to say it's in the same class as this universe. That is to say, we think the cone is this big, but as it turned out, the cone was actually this big.
Well, I'm not saying it's exactly the same matter that we have, but just something similar or analogous.
Right. Is it governed by the same laws or classes of laws that ours is?
It could be. I mean, I'm imagining maybe God created our world to be very similar to his world. Just
okay.
Because that's what he knows, and it's more interesting to interact with.
Except it's not physical.
Well,
not
in this case, he's saying it is physical.
It's like
in one case, it's possibly physical.
Watered down physical.
Okay, so if it's watered down physical, let's at least say that we can apply two terms to it. It's physical, and that there is material of some sort in it. So even if you want to say, well, it's not governed by the same laws or the same constants, the same coupling constants, or whatever else, it's still a physical material world.
Sure.
Now, on the other side, possibly you laid out, where it's physical but immaterial, then it's really this or this, but just in different size. And
yeah,
and
that's
in
a
different
illustration of projection, which
yeah.
is basically Plato's cave.
Yes, right. Plato's cave to me is more like this. Well, no, yeah, it's more like this than it is this, because I don't. Well, I guess you could say that. It could be like that too, yeah. You could probably go on that. Okay, then now let's say that it's immaterial. God's world is immaterial. Is it spatial?
Again, it could be or it could be.
So if it could be, then you still have the mapping problem. If it's not, then if you want to map it, you have to map it this way or this way. This way of the two maps is the only way to make that map not be spatial. Because what we've said here is we've stipulated that this point right here is a singularity. And so it doesn't have any space component to it at all. So the material world is not physically extended in space.
There's a lot of points here.
Yes, but what we're trying to do is, the thinking that he's talking about is right. The question is, can it be reduced? Do we need another illustration up here, or another way of talking about it, another way of mapping it?
By right, you mean plausible?
So I will shortcut here to a view that I at least want to put forward for consideration that has the advantage of not having to take the mapping problem on head on, because it can be agnostic. Whereas it says, and you guys will see this in the standby first work, here's the physical world, right? And let's say here's the physical world, here's the immaterial world. How do those interact? I don't know. Let's say that I'm just going to punt on it and be like, I don't know. But I'm going to say there's an immaterial world or a spiritual world or there's a world of minds or wills or whatever else, and it's not exactly this world. But this is where live angels, minds, souls, spirits, and anything like that. If you don't like any of those, you can erase them. It's the rest of the stuff that's still in there. But this is where that kind of thing is. And here, this is cars and rocks. Bodies.
I think this is the vision that most of us had when we were like 15, 16 or earlier.
And then this right here is God's world. With no of this, nothing of this, and nothing of this. So this is what he was like before he created it. Well, this should look familiar to you because what am I about to label who God is in each one of these? And this is my view of the Trinity. The Father is here. The Son is here, and
spirit is here. And the reason that you have three persons to the Trinity is because God does transcend the cross here. And he does transcend the cross here. And he does transcend the cross here. And when he transcends, the question is, what has to change during that transcendence? The argument I'm trying to make is, you can't take a atemporal God, a God that exists eternally and unchangingly, and then stick him into a place that changes. When he transcends, he has to do a couple things. One, he has to adopt this omnipresence. Because I want to say this. If you're talking about somebody being omnipresent in a thought, so he's not extended in space anymore, he's omnipresent, then his presence is the term presence is logically self-contradictory. Because you have to be present in space and there is no space there. So if that's true, let's say that's true, if that's true, then this makes sense because when God transcends from here to here, in order to be able to interact in that place, like this, in order for him to do this, he has to know what time it is. He has to be fully present, or whatever it is, however it is. In order to do that, he has to generate a new consciousness. So he begets the Son, who then creates the world through him and by him, all things are created. And then the Spirit is the one that inhabits this part of the
world.
Is
that contradictory or self-referencing?
In this case, well, I want to say that this is self-referential. But to say the former view, I think, is self-contradictory if you're trying to say
but that would make sense for God, right? That would make sense for God who is omnipresent.
So my point would be this. If God creates, so this could have been God before creation, but if God creates this, he has to transcend into here because as a maximally great being, he has to be present in this place. In order to be present in this place, he's going to adopt something, temporality, that he didn't have before. Now, he can't lose an essential trait because then he wouldn't be God anymore. He's essentially timeless. So in order for him to do this, he has to both be God. Still, God still has to slip in here, but he can't lose his timeless consciousness. So he has to generate a temporal consciousness. So this gives you the engine by which the Trinity could have arisen. And then it breaks the world into three transcendent sections. The reality. It breaks reality into three transcendent sections. God's room alone. Spirit's material rooms alone. Physical rooms alone. Now, you can continue to argue how this interaction goes across here. And that's a big missing piece of the model I'm talking about. This how is really important. This how is really important. I don't know. These hows are hard for me because we don't understand this how. But we do understand this how decently because here we are as bodies. It makes a lot more sense to us. And so, anyway, that's one way to start thinking about it. We'll continue this next time we're out of time. Last comment by Randy. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, I guess it's a longer question, but the yes or no answer would be, are we only restricted to three priceless? Do we know that for a fact?
So I think that if there were more of these, then my model would require that there would be more persons. So if it turned out that there was another physical world or something like that, or another material, or a new class of world that doesn't share the components of those two, God would be a quaternity. Five would be a quaternity.
But you can
basically make assumptions about what all reality is, i.e. it's only immaterial and physical, in the ways that we see it, because God is only three persons.
We have evidence for three.
Yes. And well, if this model is correct, and by the way, I get to this model not by this way, but by a set of modal logic. If this model is correct, then it means that it is impossible that there be more worlds or classes of worlds than the ones that you see now. So that's another interesting implication of the argument that I don't talk about because it's already got enough controversy with it. Okay. Next time what we'll talk about is this was often philosophical. We'll get a little bit more into the practical of what this means for you as a Christian. But let me, in the last 60 seconds, remind you of the challenge that I want to lay down for you for this week. Every day, read as much of a gospel as you can. Remember, Jesus is our master. We want to talk about Jesus as the person who came to be not even omnipresent, specifically present with us. And when he was here, and over the course of a year and a half to 2 years of ministry, he said a very small number of things. Read and know those things to such a degree that you can quote Jesus like you can quote Top Gun or whatever the movie is.
Really?
Monty Python, Search for the Holy Grail. If you can know...
I'll chew your legs off.
Yep. If you can do that with Christ, now you're putting him... You're acknowledging him as Lord and Master because you ought to know your Master's words as much as you... more than you know the other people's words. So start to become an expert in the gospel. The teachings and sayings of Jesus. And then watch how that changes your week, your day, and hopefully your month, and eventually your life. So let's commit with me to read at least three chapters of any gospel a day, three chapters a day, and pray and think over it in the course of the day and see what happens to you. All right, anything else before we go? Thank you all very much. We appreciate it.